Hello, and welcome to Talking and Chill, a roundtable podcast. I'm your host, Tamar Fox, and I'm here with Mimi Lewis.
Hey, Tamar.
Hi, Mimi. And we have Zahava Stadler joining us from Northern New Jersey. Hi, Zahava.
Hey, guys.
This week on the podcast, we're talking about the new Kaddish, a podcast about death and dying and who we are while we do it, which is a podcast by Ariana Katz, who is here with us to discuss it with us. And for our second segment, we'll be talking about the new film Indignation by director James Shamus. But first, some business. Our last podcast, we know that we had some recording and sound issues. It seems to be there's some people who got a good version of it and some people who didn't get a good version of it. So if the version you heard had a problem, I encourage you to go to our website, jpmedia.co, and listen to the SoundCloud version, which I know is good. We've had some issues with iTunes that I cannot explain, so we apologize for that, and go listen to the SoundCloud version for a clean, fixed version.
All right. But not clean in terms of content.
Never. And if you're looking for a clean podcast, I don't recommend our second segment. So, let's get this Kaddish started.
All right. So, as Tamar said, we're joined here by Ariana Katz, who's a rabbinical student at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College here in Philadelphia. Ariana developed Kaddish the Podcast with funding from Jewish Federation in Hartford and the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. We all listened to the intro episode of the podcast and are really excited to have Ariana here in person to talk about her project. So, to start, Ariana, I was wondering if you could talk about the genesis of this project, and in particular, I know I learned of your podcast when you solicited responses to a survey, and you asked people what they might be interested in regarding death, dying, and Judaism. So, I guess two questions. One, what interested you about this? And two, what were your listeners excited about?
Hey, everyone. So the project came together while I was in a class at RRC that was exploring what it means to be a rabbi that creates their own jobs, basically. And one of the prompts was, what's something that you care about that you can build a project from? And it was like halfway through the semester, and I hadn't figured out my life yet. And I realized that what I care most about is death positive, death education. I'm a member of the Philadelphia Reconstructionist Chevra Kadisha, which is the burial society in Philadelphia. And I've been active in that since I moved here for school, so about 3 years now. And in my learning of ritual around death and dying, it's become such a priority in my life and what I want to spend so much time on. So this podcast sort of came about because of the content, and then I had to think about the modality. And I've been listening to podcasts for like a decade, and so it's fun. Every like couple of years, I feel like podcasts are interesting again, mm-hmm. and we're in a moment where they're interesting, at least to the four of us and whoever else is listening to this. And so it seemed like an interesting way of delivering content. I don't really tell stories using audio in the way that podcasts do. I'm used to writing sermons or like reading books or writing or whatever, but using audio to convey messages is a totally new format, so it's been fun to explore. This survey was this totally random thing where I asked a bunch of questions and created a Google form and put it out into the internet. And overnight, I had about 55 responses from people I knew, but also second and third layer of folks removed. And the questions were, what are you interested in learning about? What are things that you want to make sure we handle carefully? What are other podcasts you listen to? How often do you listen to podcasts? And some of the topics were structured around a couple of main ideas. So biological family and chosen family, how to handle losing your friends, losing siblings, complicated grief around estranged relationships with parents, and how to have a Shiva process or a mourning process for those relationships. Multiple losses, the funeral industry, there were a lot of people that had like a lot of questions about how it works and how it's funded. And then just, I'm scrolling through this list I have, and disenfranchised grief was just such an overwhelming response. People who are seeing that their grief stories are not being fully held. either by mainstream stories about what loss is, or ritual, or resources they find within a religious community. And, you know, in a week there were about 100 responses, and I really credit that to the fact that there's a lack of conversation. There's a lack of permission that we are granted and grant each other to actually talk about the myriad of ways that death and terminal illness have impacted our lives. And so any outlet we have to actually talk about it is desperately needed. Mm. So it's humbling. I hope what I'm creating is useful, because I think that we can all be participating in that.
Yeah, cool. So I'm curious, the first episode is about the Kaddish itself, and I'm interested in how, if making that episode changed your feelings about the podcast, about the prayer at the podcast.
Both, probably.
Right. And just kind of your reaction to Kaddish itself, because that's something that we didn't really get in the podcast, and I'm curious about it.
Yeah. So this past Sunday, I watched Yentl for the first time, and I don't know how I made it this far without seeing it, because it's at the intersections of a lot of things I care about.
Is musicals one of the
music? Yeah, I would say I would say it's musicals, like nostalgia for a shtetl. I would say love of Talmud.
Barbara
Streisand,
I have to assume.
Sure,
being a woman.
And queerness, like, yeah. That's like, right. What else is there, right? Yeah. So I made it this long without seeing Yentl, and, you know, no spoilers, but it happens in, like, the first 10 minutes, so Yentl's father dies. Cut to, why they have Papa, can you hear me? I don't know, I learned a lot. And she says Kaddish for him. So they're at the funeral, and they say, who's going to say Kaddish? And she takes the siddur, and she says it, and she does a pretty good rendition there. There are just so many moments where you see the Kaddish depicted in pop culture, because those of us who are writing the scripts, who have Kaddish, like, in our guts, like, it comes out. And I mentioned this in the show, but in the L Word, in the, like, second season, Jenny Schechter is, like, retracing her family's Holocaust history, and is really processing it, but instead of saying the Kaddish, she recites the Kiddush, so she's, like, very solemnly and, like, full of lots of generational trauma, blessing grape juice.
I had this dream.
I laughed so hard when I heard that in the podcast.
I have a dream of just a compilation of all of the cringeworthy moments that Jewish prayer has made it into a TV show, and it's just like, oh, they're so awkward.
Oh, anyway. Gosh, that would be a great supercut.
We'll find someone to do that for me.
There's a Hallel Holidays one that you can
sample. Okay, cool.
So my own experiences of the Kaddish, I mean, I think it's woven in there, and something I'm learning from y'all, especially, is, like, storytelling and letting yourself be really present in it. So for me, the Kaddish is such a primary piece of prayer because it can balance so many emotions all at once and so many different kinds of places that we find ourselves in a service at once. I'm saying Kaddish this year for my mother's best friend who was like a bonus mom, we called her, or I've been using that language to explain her. And Lisa was Episcopalian, and every time I stand up and say Kaddish for her, I have a different experience. Like, sometimes she is, like, on my shoulder, laughing. Sometimes she's petting my hair. Sometimes she's very far away. Sometimes I'm distracted and she, like, crashes in on me in the last moments of the prayer. And I think all of the stuff that is built around the prayer itself is more important than the words, which is what I was trying to explore with that first episode. And it's such an interesting sociological study to take one prayer and think about all the different ways that it plays out. And then also as, like, a political being, the Kaddish is a way of bearing witness to all of the death and dying that's happening around us, and has been a really important place. That, and hearing rabbis in Philadelphia chant Eicha at Black Lives Matter rallies, those are the two pieces of liturgy that have really helped me connect to my emotional self as well as my political self and carry those two things together. Hmm.
So, Ariana, I have a question about the way you structured the first episode. There are, I think, two clear halves. One, in the beginning, you're exploring the quote-unquote original history of the Kaddish, the sort of legend that attaches to the origins of the prayer in traditional sources. And in the second half, you're speaking to a liturgical poet about a modern and personalized English language version of the Kaddish that she has written. And I was wondering whether this this sort of dual approach where you explore sort of the traditional version and then a non-traditional modernized version of something is a duality that you're interested in exploring as a theme in future episodes.
I like seeing them as separate because in my head they felt so connected to each other, and that laying the groundwork of the myth of Rabbi Akiva only made, like, the second part of the show talking with Elliot Batsedek about her liturgy only made sense if we understood some of the undergirding of it. I think for myself, I find that the way I engage with text is always surprisingly traditional, and so I want there to be a thread of text and history that runs through all of these conversations, while also keeping them accessible for people with a variety of learning or a variety of religious movements that they're affiliated with. I am really inspired by different different shows that that do their work in acts, and that they are telling the same story but dividing them. And so I think that the haves there are also speaking to that, that there are different phases in which we can approach the same issue.
It's fascinating to me that you really feel like that you sort of felt like they flowed so naturally from one to the other, because I felt like Elliot Batsedek's Kaddish was such a reorientation of the prayer in a way that felt almost startling to me. And one thing that I think really came through very strongly for me is that the traditional liturgical Kaddish is very God-focused, and there's no first person in it at all. And hers is very much about the personal experience of the mourning and how the mourner is feeling and how the mourner's soul is experiencing. And so to me, it felt like totally turning the camera around. So to me, that made them very distinct, but I can also see how you would, I mean, they're also very much in dialogue with each other.
Yeah, it's pulling on this idea that I'm really obsessed with, that we touch on in the piece of Rachel Adler saying, if we don't mean the words we say when we're praying, then why are we bothering to say them? And sort of the inverse of what are we getting away with saying that we actually secretly mean but aren't taking up the space or owning the fact that we believe it. And so when Eliot's Kaddish actually speaks to the fact that we're standing up straight and weeping in the middle of like a synagogue or wherever we happen to pray, and actually speaks to what some of those emotions might be, it feels like such a moment of saying, let's actually talk about what's happening here. Let's be honest about what this prayer is doing for us. In a way that's dissonant with the function of liturgy, but it speaks to that project.
Yeah. I grew up in a congregation where everybody stood for the Mourner's Kaddish, and I think that in Reformed communities, that's a function of this idea that we should all be saying Kaddish for people whose entire families were wiped out in the Holocaust. Or at least that was what I was told growing up. And since I left that community, I've started sitting and only standing for the Kaddish when I am mourning somebody, when it's someone's yard site or the anniversary of their death. And the experience is so different. I think when everybody's standing and saying the same words, you think about the words. And when you're standing and other people around you are sitting, it's, for me at least, those few times that I've had to do it, it felt more about the experience of standing in front of your community and of thinking about the person, rather than just, this is what we do every service, we all stand.
I never thought about it, but I always stand for Mourner's Kaddish, even when I'm not saying it, but I don't say it unless I have a yard sign or something, and I do think that it would feel like I stand essentially in order, both because like I stand for Everett Kaddish, and because I think it's to be kind of like supportive of people who are doing it, because I had to say, when I was saying Kaddish for my mother, I was not infrequently the only person saying Kaddish, And it can be really, a really intimidating experience. And just, like, feel, like, the grief aside, you're also kind of, like, a little bit on stage if you're the only one who's standing up. And so to have somebody else standing, if even if they're not speaking, just, like, with you felt safer to me. But I don't know that it would be that... I don't really love the idea of, like, everybody standing for Kaddish, because it does actually kind of diminish the power of being, like, I'm standing up here to do this thing. And the fact that it... I feel like that mimics a little bit the isolation that you feel when you're grieving. And so if everybody does it, then it really takes away from that.
I actually have two friends who met, they call it, by being Kaddish buddies. Like, they were both mourning parents in, like, pretty much the same calendar year, and at various shuls around town would sort of spot each other, and eventually it was like, I'm also doing that, and it's so touching, you know, it's like that sense of community, and, like, you're identifying yourself to everyone there, but also to the other people, and I just thought that was so beautiful.
That's something that Ari Goldman talks about in Living a Year of Kaddish, the experience of taking on saying Kaddish for a parent for 11 months and seeing people over the course of that year, and what those relationships are like when your whole relationship is being at Minyan in the morning together. And from that book, I really learned the presence and the possibility of asking someone who they're saying Kaddish for, and that actually being a, like, a kind thing to do and not invasive, but saying, like, I saw you there standing to say Kaddish, like, who are you remembering, who are you giving honor to today? Because I think either everyone standing or one person standing, it plays with the idea that you have to keep this to yourself. Because we have a moment carved out in the service to say, like, there are people who are not here right now. And so in the way that walking up to someone does that same thing, like, I see something's going on. What's happening?
Yeah.
You know, Ariana, I think that's very much in the spirit of the way you've described the podcast, this notion that, like, death isn't this shameful thing that we're not supposed to ask or talk about, but that it's that we should put it front and center in at least some conversation. And I wanted to ask you about a phrase you used earlier, and I think it's a phrase that also appears in the formal description of your podcast, at least on its Facebook page. You used the phrase death education, saying, you know, we're sort of lacking in death education as a Jewish community. And that is not a phrase I've ever heard anyone use before. So I guess, you know, that's anecdotal evidence that it's true. I'm wondering what you mean by death education, because I could understand what you would mean by opening up a conversation around death or being honest about our experiences, but I'm not sure what you mean by death education.
Yeah. So the folks at the Gamliel Institute, which is a project of Kivvot V'Nichum, who do death education for Jews, they have this side project. So the Gamliel Institute trains people who are interested in learning more about the ritual practices associated with death and dying. So tahara, which is the ritual washing, and shmira, which is the guarding of someone after they've died, as well as the continued work of the chevra to be the resource in a Jewish community for people in these moments. They're saying, here are the tools we have, here's how you do them. I think about death education the way I think about sex education. It's something that we have a lot of questions about. There's a lot of logistical pieces we don't understand. It'll happen in our lives at some point, or maybe multiple points. Even if we try to avoid it, someone we know will engage with this topic. And it's something that we, like, have a hard time accessing information about. And in a moment of crisis, you really need information about both of those topics, and sometimes it's hard to find. So I see the stuff around logistics of death and dying, or the theology around death and dying, is something that we don't talk about, because, you know, at least in the communities that I roll with and that raised me, are very superstitious. So we don't want to talk about it, because Kinahara, we should bring it on. And we don't want to seem morbid, and we don't want to, you know, insert XYZ stereotype about people who think about this too much. And I think it comes from a lot of fear. And so the inverse, I think, of fear a lot of times is education, and death education brings with it history and information and calmness. And so there are a lot of folks who are doing this work, and the Order of the Good Death is a crew of folks who talk about death positivity, which basically says there's nothing wrong with thinking or talking about mortality, and in fact we have to. And they're another huge resource in thinking about what our education needs to be. Like, what's the syllabus of stuff you need? I think about the experience of cooking Shabbos dinner with friends and having them call a family member to say, okay, I'm making this dish, what am I missing? And when in our lives we deal with death and dying, we often wish we could call someone, maybe even the person that we're burying, to say, okay, this has happened, this has never happened before, what's the next step? And I think death education is one of the ways that we can make that bridge sooner.
My father recently, like, what do you say, became trained or joined a Chevra Kedisha? I guess he joined the Chevra, yeah. And I think about the, you know, like, common phrase these days is, like, your Jewish journey, you know? And it, like, for him, joining the Chevra Kedisha has been, like, this reawakening of some spiritual self. Mm. Especially, like, he's raised his kid. He became educated himself Jewishly. He raised his kids to have a Jewish education. Now he's, like, retiring, and this is this whole new world of Jewish obligation and ritual. And it's been really cool to watch him become death educated, you know, and share with others.
So you know, being in the Chevra Kedisha is something that you're supposed to keep pretty to yourself. It's not something that you go around sharing or advertising necessarily. And so I have a lot of questions about talking about my experience of doing it. And I think, right, so it comes from a lot of different reasons why the Chevra is a secret. One, it's modeling itself, we model ourselves after the burial of Moses. So the story is written that when Moses dies, or before he dies, he goes up the mountain, and then the pasuk is, and he buried him there. Thank you, Hebrew, no capital letters, lots of pronouns, that doesn't help us. And so, on one hand, you know, it's Hashem, like, God buried Moses, like, such an honorable person. God was the Chevra Kedisha, the kit in the caboodle that buried Moshe Rabbeinu. And then there's another story that, okay, well, maybe it wasn't God, maybe it was a stranger who happened upon Moses as he was dying. Maybe he helped him die. Maybe the stranger was also a hospice chaplain, hospice nurse. Uh-huh. Moshe dies, and then the stranger buries Moses and walks away. Because it says in the next pasuk, and no one knows where he is buried. Because we know, if God forbid, we should make it into a place that we all go to and make pilgrimage, not something we want to do. So we have no idea who buried Moses. If it was a stranger, he came and went and didn't tell anyone else. If it was God, in God's great kindness and compassion, buried Moses. And so in that way, the Chevra Kedisha is anonymous. And also, if you're in a town and there's a Chevra Kedisha and you know your uncle dies, you know the people in that Chevra Kedisha buried your uncle, and your relationship has always changed.
Right.
And I think there's a third thing, which is that people think death is icky. We have it built into our tradition that, you know, it's impure to touch a dead body. And if you're a Kohen and you follow that, then you can't actually not enter into a cemetery, and you can't touch a dead body, and you can't be in the same room. And there's a piece that's ritual observance, in my opinion. I think there's a piece that's that ick factor, that death denial, that Judaism does a good way of combating with all of our ritual, but is still in that. So maybe you look at the people in your chevra and you're like, I don't want to, maybe they don't come over my house for Shabbos, because you know what they do in the evenings.
Right. Or I was also thinking, like, maybe you don't want to know who's going to see you naked.
Mm-hmm. Like a modesty thing also.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Ooh, that sounds icky. He'll be there, you know?
I feel like once I'm dead, whatever. Yeah. Like, go ahead and look.
So, Ariana, you just said something interesting about sort of ritual as our way of combating death denial. And one thing that that made me think of is that in your inaugural episode, you use a phrase a couple of times, magic words, about the Kaddish, that the Kaddish is these magic words that people say and that, you know, that sort of magically it accomplishes something for the person who's passed away or for themselves as the grieving. And I actually am often very thankful for the magic words that Judaism supplies in difficult situations, especially around death. And this made me think not just of Kaddish, but of two other formulations. So one is when you hear someone has died. Well, really, this attaches to hearing any unfortunate news, but people use it most when someone has died. The traditional thing to say is Baruch Dayan HaEmet, like blessed is the true judge. Because if you react to something as tragic, like it wasn't supposed to happen, then you're sort of questioning the righteousness of what God has done. But at the same time, people don't have this like instinctive outpouring of like, well, it's an excellent thing that this tragedy has happened. So in that way, Judaism supplies this sort of formulation to maybe have you voice the correct thing that you may not be feeling. And therefore, you sort of say what you hope you'll arrive at emotionally at some point. And the other formulation that I have appreciated is when you are paying a Shiva call. So when somebody is sitting Shiva during the 7 days after a close family member has died, there's a formulation that you say as you sort of leave, because what on earth are you going to say when you say goodbye to someone sitting Shiva? And there's this formulation wishing them comfort among the mourners of Zion and Israel. And that makes it so much easier to sort of take your leave of this very difficult situation. And, you know, I'd never thought of the Kaddish in those terms, because Kaddish to me has always, weirdly enough, been a little bit removed from the immediate death, right? There's this long period of saying Kaddish, and usually you don't encounter somebody in their first moments of saying Kaddish, whereas when you're paying a Shiva call, you know, that's a really fraught moment in a person's mourning process. I'm curious sort of how you think about these magic words in general as they attach to death and dying.
That was beautiful. I mean, I say magic words with a lot of kavod, like with a lot of honor and gratitude for magic, because I think a lot of Judaism is rooted in incantation and ancient magic. So I think we're carrying something on importantly in our liturgy. Yeah, so in terms of like knowing what to say, I think that's right, of saying like, you might not have the right words, you might not be able to vamp here, here's a formula. Yeah, so I also have noticed a teacher of mine from the summer doing clinical pastoral education in Boston quoted her teacher, who said that when people die, everyone becomes Orthodox, meaning for progressive Jews, but I think for all of us, that when we're experiencing dying, we want to make sure we do it right. That we take on observances we maybe haven't taken on before and think that it's the right thing to do, even if we've decided previously it wasn't. And I think for people of every denomination, there's this fear that we're going to get it wrong, that we won't have the right formula, and that we only get one shot at burying grandma, and we want to make sure we do it right. And so having these formulas that you talk about help us move through the social, as well as that deep, intense emotional fear of getting it wrong. My upcoming episode that's going to be coming out at the beginning of September is about advanced directives in hospice. And one of the things that we talk about is how advanced directives and living wills are a way of communicating to the people who are making your decisions for you that you love them and you trust them and you know they're making the right choice. Because to be an executor of someone's advanced directive or to be their power of attorney means to be worrying that you're doing it wrong. And it's something just like so sweet and human and lovely that we have no idea what we're doing because we've never done this before. Like you ask 10 Jews, what is the world to come like? What is heaven like? No one knows. We're like, here's a guess. Like, this is what my teacher told me, but I don't really know because we don't know. And I think that ties really closely to, we don't always know what we're doing, so we're going to keep doing this old thing because the ancientness has brought us healing. So we're going to assume, all right, close enough.
I also think about the contrast between the words of the magic phrases that you've given, Zahava, and the experience or emotion behind them, because, you know, you might say Baruch Dayan HaEmet and, like, be filled with a feeling that is so different from those words. And I think that's exactly what your intro episode was explaining, the feeling of saying the words, the meaning of the words, and just mm-hmm. so much communication in between.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, I really loved the first episode, but I also thought it was so interesting how little it did engage with the meaning of the words. Mm-hmm. I think that it's so common for people to, like, really just gloss right over the meaning of Kaddish. And I get that in a lot of senses, but I actually, like, really felt that, the meaning of the words. Like, I didn't feel it as, like, an incantation. I felt it as, like, for whatever reason, I had, like, a horrific 5-year period where, like, it seemed like half of my family dropped dead. Mm. And I really found that saying, for whatever reason, I came out of that, like, believing in God more and not less. And I really found Kaddish to be a powerful statement of, like, how I really was surprised to feel. And I think, you know, I don't expect everybody to have that reaction. I still don't really understand why I had that reaction, but I think it's kind of sad the way, to me, that Kaddish has become more of a magic word and less of a text that we engage with on as what it is. Yeah. You know, it has a, like, reputation, mm-hmm, and it has a connotation, but the, like, you know, the pshat, the simple meaning of the text often is kind of, like, explained in one sentence, mm-hmm, which is, like, not really fair to do considering that it's longer than one sentence, and or just not addressed at all. And I think that there's, I don't know, it's just, it's mm-hmm. so interesting to me that is kind of how it has ended up, that the Kaddish, which is, like, a really profound statement about God, has become not that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something that people, like, really connect with, mm-hmm, and really find to be really important, but I don't think people really do connect it with their own mm-hmm. conception of God most of the time.
I wonder if that's because Jews don't always talk about God. Like, we don't...
Yeah.
Like, we say God compulsively all the time, but we don't actually, like, talk about belief.
Right.
And I also... It's an incredible story of coming out on the other side and actually, like, meaning the words you're saying. But we say those words over the course of any service multiple times.
Right.
And so I think the idea that they're also, like, weaving something around us as we say them, when we say, and now we're going to say them as the mourner's Kaddish. Like, we should be talking about the words that we're praying all the time. And when we say them in the mourner's Kaddish, we're not introducing new concepts.
Right.
Or even saying new words. And so I wonder how we would engage with, like, the Chatzi Kaddish or right. the Kaddish Rabbanan when it's almost all the same.
Right. In a way, Kaddish, I always think of Kaddish as just, like, a placeholder. Mm-hmm. Like, it's almost like the like, blank page at the beginning of a chapter or something. You know, it's, like, the half page that you get that says, you know, chapter 11. And that's, we have Kaddishes all through the service that are just, like, benchmarkers for where we are. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting that, like, there's, like, a slightly longer than usual benchmark for Mourner's Kaddish then. That mm-hmm. we have some... We use the same thing, but there's something about it that we give to this task.
Rabbi Rachel Berenblatt calls Kaddish a gateway or a doorway that you pass through one part to another part. And then for Mourner's Kaddish, I guess we're transitioning into a thing that it's its own space altogether.
Hmm. Thank you so much, Ariana, for joining us and for sharing your podcast with the public. We'll link to it in our show notes. And I think we all highly encourage people to give it a listen.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
Yeah. Ariana, do you want to stick around for endorsements at the end of the show?
I'd love to.
Great.
Awesome.
So for our second segment, we're going to be discussing a new movie, Indignation. Indignation is an adaptation of a late career Philip Roth novel. I think it came out in 2008. And the movie's now in limited release as an independent film. It's directed by James Shamus, and it focuses on a boy, Marcus Messner, a Jewish boy from, I believe, Irvington, New Jersey, near Newark, who is finishing high school. And in order to avoid the Korean War draft, because it's 1951, he accepts a scholarship to a small private Christian college in Ohio. And the movie deals to a large degree with the culture clash of him going both as a Jew but also as an atheist to this Christian college, the peers that he encounters there, and the relationship that he develops with a female student, a non-Jewish female student, as well as with the dean who sort of personifies the institution, and how his relationship with both his parents evolves while he's there. So it's an interesting film. It's been pretty well reviewed. It's got like an 80% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. I think from our pre-show discussion, the critics may have liked this movie more than we did. But I do think there's some interesting Jewish relevance to discuss. So how did you guys feel about the film?
Take it away, Tamar.
I hated this movie so much. I really wanted it to be over so much earlier than it was over, and I really didn't, like, Marcus is just a pretentious jerk, and he just kind of, but he's a pretentious jerk who then gets infuriated by other pretentious people. There's a what feels like 11-hour long conversation with the dean in the middle of the movie that was just felt so much like torture. Like, why are we still in this conversation between these two insufferable people? And I have read a not insignificant amount of Philip Roth, but he has written so many books that it's hard for, you know, even if you've read like 6 or 7 books, that's just not that many of his. That's not that big of a fraction for his work. And I just think the way he writes about women is totally gross and offensive. And I thought the main female character in this movie was just like so bizarre. I thought it was like weirdly acted, and I thought the role was absurd, and I think that Philip Roth does actually have interesting things to say about religion and like trying to figure out how to make your way in a world where there's a religion that's been kind of deep dyed into you, but you don't really like feel it. But this movie did not say anything really interesting to me, and I hated it.
We call that a scorched earth review.
I mean, that is like not, that's just like me being like sad that I spent 2 hours in the theater. I have like lengthy terrible things to say about this movie, but that was the like Cliff's Notes, please don't see this movie or give these people money.
Yeah. I also did not like the movie. I similarly have icky feelings about Philip Roth and the way he depicts women. As I've mentioned to you guys, my mom and dad met in college, so around the same age as Marcus and Olivia, his non-Jewish love interest, and my dad was Jewish, my mom not Jewish. So there were like these just infuriating, the way he treated Olivia's sexual energy and her non-Jewishness, he almost, it felt, and maybe this is because I've read other Philip Roth books, it feels like he portrays non-Jewish women as like these sexual beings who are also like fragile because they have messed up families and usually some mental health issues. I hate that. But I do think that, the movie was trying to say something Jewishly. So Marcus's father is a kosher butcher, and there's something about kashrut there. I mean, the first date that Marcus and Olivia go on, she makes a point of ordering escargot, and he doesn't eat it. Snails. He doesn't eat it, and then he does eat it. Right? Doesn't he eat the escargot?
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, okay. So there's something about, like, kashrut and disobeying rules.
And, like, taboo things that you, like, are excited to actually interact with.
Right, and, like, right, definitely, like, repressed sexual urges that then finally get acted upon. And
if you have been thinking to yourself, I would like to watch a movie with a sex dream in a kosher butcher shop, this is the film for you.
So Zahava, what was your take on the film?
So I think I didn't hate it quite as much as Tamar, but I wouldn't say I enjoyed it. I think that the central, quote-unquote, relationship between Marcus and Olivia was just profoundly uninteresting to me. So I was kind of thinking of her as a depressive pixie dream girl, if that makes sense. Like, she's certainly not high energy, but it's just sort of this, like, useless mystery that's just there to facilitate the plot and not so much that she's a person. But I kind of want to ignore Olivia Hutton as a character entirely. And what was interesting to me about this movie was nothing about that, and only really Marcus's encounter with this Christian college and how he experienced it as somebody who kept being categorized as a Jew, right? He was there to check the Jew box in their diversity campaign or whatever it was. And he was expected to do that in a very specific way. He was expected to room with Jews and join the Jewish fraternity. And, you know, he put down his father's profession as butcher, and the dean insisted, oh, but he's a kosher butcher, right? And like, there was a very, very obvious categorization, whereas he wanted to be there as an atheist and as a person of religious neutrality, who is there to stand on principle and to oppose going to chapel, not because he was Jewish, but because he was an atheist. And I thought there was an interesting, I thought it was interesting to see the notion that we were prepared to accept a certain kind of diversity, and you're posing a different kind of diversity. We couldn't possibly accept that. And how Jews of different stripes have sort of experienced their categorization by wider American society.
Yeah, I think there's something, you know, you hear people talking now about how atheists are still seen as untrustworthy by a lot of people. Statistics are just like, we're not, as a country, we could never elect an atheist because there's just so many, too many people in this country who can't handle that. And there was something of that in this movie that I think doesn't actually get talked about that much, that like there is a weird stigma against atheists, which is like the rest of us believe in magic people and those people don't. Like, I don't know, that doesn't seem like a very defensible prejudice to have, but it is something that we kind of accept. And I'm not that used to hearing, Yeah. I mean, I felt like that part of it was very reasonable. I just would rather that reasonable point not be made by a guy who is otherwise so insufferable.
But isn't that sort of the stereotype of atheists?
It is now.
Okay.
I don't know that it has been that way for a long time. Right. But I do think that it is now.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, Marcus was insufferable in the authentic manner of very earnest 18-year-olds.
You don't think he was, like, extra insufferable, though?
I do think he was an extremely difficult character in that way. But I do feel like I know people like that. Or when I was a college freshman, I had peers like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something about the way that this movie deals with the Jewish mother that's pretty surprising.
Yes.
I was not... So Marcus's mother comes to visit him at the end of this movie, and they have a... She seems relatively reasonable in a movie of people who are terrible. And then she's seeming reasonable all along until like the last 5 minutes of the movie when she suddenly... I found her to just be like, ugh, gross and annoying again. But I was surprised at how affectionate the movie seemed to be with her, given that that is not the reputation that Philip Roth has in terms of his like depiction of Jewish women is not actually affectionate usually. So I was surprised by it, but also, I don't know, just like sad that it kind of crashed and burned in the very last minute.
So the moment you're talking about is Marcus's mom gives him an ultimatum that he needs to leave Olivia in order for the mom to stay in her marriage to Marcus's dad. And I guess I actually thought of that moment, first of all, it could have been more Jewish mother stereotypical, that she was like inserting herself in his business and playing on guilt. But the way it was acted and written, I assume, is that there was more of like a wise protection about her insistence that he leave her because
that he leave Olivia. She just seems much more pragmatic than neurotic, which right. is like very was really surprising to me, and I thought was like, all right, well, that's one thing I can say about this movie. And then like that scene, she just like goes off on how you can never trust people who are weak because they're really strong, because they can destroy your life. And it was just like, ugh.
So I understand why that scene is distasteful, but I actually didn't think it undermined the pragmatism of her character at all. Like, to me, so we have this notion of stereotypical Jewish mothers as both sort of caregivers and as these very sort of anxious, overbearing characters. And in Marcus's family, his father perhaps fits those descriptions much more than his mother does. And his mother's the one who sort of holds it together and is very practical. I appreciated that in and of itself, that there was this other depiction of a Jewish mother that didn't feel condescending. But in that final moment, Tamar, that you're reacting to, she's, as Mimi said, I think acting out of protective interest, right? That Olivia is genuinely someone with a great deal of pain and problems. And it's obvious to anyone who would watch that she holds this sort of spellbinding fascination for Marcus in a way that could very easily pull him into a vortex. And I think it is also pretty obvious
that... Disagree. She's just the only person who's given him a blowjob. I feel really strongly that, like, he's just fixating on, like, the literal closest person. And she keeps showing up. Like, he's in college. There's going to be another girl around who's going to be willing to do that.
Fair enough. We've had no evidence of that.
Marcus's roommate,
he seems pretty fixated. Whether he's being dumb about it, he's certainly being dumb about it, but he does seem pretty fixated. And so I think it is both not unexpected and also not impractical for a mother's main concern to be, let my child not be pulled into this vortex of this person who has tremendous amount of problems and with whom there's no possibility of a healthy relationship. And what I think is really interesting about that scene is she explicitly says, I don't care about intermarriage. It's totally fine that she's not Jewish. You're a modern child. You can do whatever you want and have whatever family you want. You live in the 20th century, and why shouldn't you? Just not with her. She'll pull you down into the quicksand. And that is not at all the conversation I was expecting. And that was really interesting to me.
Yeah. What, just one more thing before we close out this segment. I'm curious what you took away from the depiction of the Jewish fraternity in this film, which I thought was, like, really confusing to me. Like, at first, they show up, they invite Marcus to join the fraternity, and he basically tells them to get lost. And later on, they, like, show up and help him out, and actually he turns out to really need them, even while he's, like, really scorning them. I don't know. I was thinking last night about, like, what do I think is going on there? And I don't really know.
It also seemed in the film, probably in the book, that the book was struggling with what is this Jewish fraternity. We meet two characters from the fraternity. One is, like, a jock who is who's like leads the Panhellenic Council and gets great grades, and the other is this like nebbishy bookworm who other people pay to attend chapel for them. He's sort of a pushover. So the way that they showed this Jewish fraternity seemed kind of like, we don't really know what to make of these guys, how they wind up together, except that they're Jewish. But
that's what matters, right? The only thing that matters as a uniting factor in this context is that you be Jewish, right? Because this is a Christian college. There's a comment at some point that there are like 80 Jews in a campus of 1,500 or something around that. And that they, you know, this is their way to band together. It is sort of the only safe and acceptable way to be the campus Jews, and that's the only commonality they need.
Yeah.
I don't know. There was something, I was just thinking about, like, Jewish fraternity men I have known and, like, what the connotation of a Jewish fraternity was to me when I was in college, and I just think there's, it is a weirdly kind of unexplored topic in the Jewish world is...
I'm so down. Let's do it. A podcast.
I guess I would have to do some serious research because I was not in a fraternity or a sorority. I obviously was not in a fraternity. I was definitely not in a sorority either. So I don't know. But there is something about like that both like the actual thing of it, that they were just thrown together literally just because they were Jewish, and the image of the Jewish fraternity now versus then. And it seemed like the movie was initially very scornful of the idea of a fraternity, and then a fraternity is kind of like the thing that helps him out in his moment of need. Although, spoiler, doesn't really last. So, I don't know. I'm just kind of curious in like the idea of Jews being bound together just because we're Jews, and like both like a thing that you want to escape, but you can't escape because they're really the only ones who can help you out.
That's so Jewish.
Right. It's true. It's true. But it's also, I guess, like, Philip Roth really believes, like, you can't escape. They're the only ones that can help you. But also, they're going to, like, kill you. That is, I guess, a pretty good summation of how Philip Roth seems to feel about Jews.
Yeah. Wow. Indignation. See it or don't. It's all fine.
Did you find this movie at all funny?
No.
No.
Somebody that I was talking to earlier today was said, I thought it was so funny. And that is a reaction that a lot of people have to Philip Roth that I just do not get. Like, I literally, if you gave me this movie or a book by Philip Roth and were like, find the funny part, I would be like, I have no idea. Like, this is not funny to me at all.
There were many people in the theater when I was there just laughing their heads off at things that the mom would say and at Marcus's discomfort with sex. But I thought that was all cringeworthy. So,
ugh. I think I smiled, maybe even laughed a little once in the moment very early in the film where Marcus and his peers are paying a shiva call to, yes, I laughed during the shiva call, right? Marcus and his peers are paying a shiva call to the mother of a classmate who has been killed in the Korean War. And she tells him, you avoid this war however you can. And she's reassured, it's okay. He accepted the scholarship to a college. He's not getting drafted. It's a Christian college in Ohio. And she says, Ohio, how will you keep kosher? And, like, that was a moment where people in my theater laughed. And I laughed a little bit, but I was like, you know what? I would have the same question.
Oh, I love you, Zahala. Well, we should take our podcast on the road to Ohio and see what kosher food we can find.
I'm going to bring you down to Arkansas to test your skills.
Oh, good times. All right, well, I think you would do better to watch a powered-off TV set than watch this movie for 2 hours, but some people love it, so.
Let us know what you think.
Yeah, please. Please tell us if you love it. Explain why, because I don't get it. All right, well, now let's go to things that we did like. All right, Ariana, are you ready to endorse?
I think so.
If it's a bad endorsement, we're going to throw you out. So.
Okay, great. Cool.
All right, so what do you have to endorse?
I wanted to endorse the August 12th Jews for Black Lives Matter action organized by Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. I listened yesterday to an audio episode of Trafe that recorded the action itself, and hearing the shofar being called and the divrei Torah being given in the streets was incredible to listen to on a train in a different city, and such an important action for everyone to take notice of.
Cool.
I second that endorsement. It was an amazing podcast and really cool hearing the recordings from the street. So
it's Jay Fredge does a podcast, and it's
so the one that I heard was on Trafe podcast.
Got it. Okay.
And I want to endorse, well, I want to ask for other people's endorsements. I recently got engaged.
Hey!
Very
exciting. We're you with candy right now.
So much singing has followed me around, which is really lovely.
I think I actually held a talis chuppah over you at some Shabbos recently.
You did. Yeah. It was lovely. And I have found so much joy in, like, announcing our engagement, and then we bought Anita Diamond's New Jewish Wedding, and I haven't cracked it yet, and I feel like maybe I need some wedding education. So if people have articles, or, like, it would be awesome if it's a podcast, because I have a long commute, about making a wedding and getting married Jewishly or non, I would love that. And the second thing I want to endorse is actually, as I've mentioned many times, I grew up Reform, which means Debbie Friedman was, like, the other rabbi in every synagogue I went to. Debbie Friedman has this really great recording of Mourner's Kaddish, which is like bluesy in nature. And my father, who lost both of his parents very close to one another, loves this recording and says that it really helped him a lot. So we'll link to that, to Debbie Friedman's version of the Kaddish.
Cool. I've never heard that.
I'm really.
And I feel like how does one escape childhood without hearing Debbie Friedman's complete repertoire?
Yeah, so Debbie Friedman apparently stopped singing this because there was backlash. Like, how could you put the Mourner's Kaddish to music? So she stopped performing it.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Can I just say, this is how orthodox I am. I think I had not heard of Debbie Friedman at all until college.
Wow.
Sahava, I love you. Also, I'm jealous of you because I think I heard of Debbie Friedman a bit too much.
I shed many tears when she died. Her memory should be for a blessing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. She is an amazing person, but also, like, there's definitely such thing as Debbie Friedman overload. All right, thank you so much, Ariana.
Thanks, y'all.
It's been wonderful to have you. Zahava, do you want to get us started?
Sure. So my endorsement is a 2-year-old piece on tablet that I just discovered. And I'm recommending this because as we record, we are not too long after Tisha B'Av, which is, you know, the sort of preeminent day of mourning on the Jewish calendar. And there is an essay in Tablet from 2014 called By the Arch of Titus, Spending Tisha B'Av in Rome. It's by Jake Marmer. Have either of you read this piece?
No.
I came across it. It was linked from something that came out this year. So I came across it. And it's an interesting meditation on what it means to mourn something as a Jew and as a member of the Jewish people, and perhaps apropos of the conversation that we had with Ariana, but not just in terms of mourning the destruction of the temple, and quite literally, because under the Arch of Titus, you're seeing the depiction of the exile of the Jewish people at the hands of the Romans, but also Jake Marmer grew up as a child in Soviet Ukraine, and there are some very specific kinds of mourning that the Jews of the former Soviet Union would observe on Tisha B'Av, the mourning for the people of their ancestral town, and how he relates through the prism of personal memory and national memory combined to this idea of Jewish mourning. So I thought it was a really interesting meditation on those issues, and I definitely recommend it. It's called By the Arch of Titus, Spending Tisha B'Av in Rome, and it came out in August of 2014 for Tisha B'Av that year.
Awesome.
Cool. I would like to look at that. So my endorsement is to visit your local criminal court. And I say this because I have been supporting somebody who is going through Philadelphia criminal court procedures right now, and I had never been to a criminal court before, even though I'm a big fan of Law and Order, and I didn't know what to expect, and I found that it's actually really effective to me, and I think it's really good preparation for Rosh Hashanah. Basically, in my experience, you go into a room, there's a bunch of people who've been assigned to a room at a certain time, and then there's a long period where the lawyers are consulting with different people for maybe a minute or two, and then eventually the judge comes in and they just run down the list of everybody who's been assigned for that hour, and the lawyers have an opportunity to say whether or not they're ready, or if they like need this paper or need that paper, if there's a witness who's not there, policeman or woman who is not present or is present, and very few cases actually move on from that point. Almost everything seems to get rescheduled at that point. In my experience of now going to criminal court like 5 or 6 times, it's like I've never seen anything happen at all other than that. But there is this moment as the names are being called where it really reminds me of Una Tana Tokef, of this idea of like everybody is like a sheep going under the staff of God and your name is being called and you're like essentially in criminal court and you have to account for your deeds. And it's just really powerful and meaningful leading up to the High Holidays. We still have a ways to go until Rosh Hashanah, but I recommend doing this as a more literal preparation for the holidays. I think Rosh Hashanah somehow gets like deeply coated in honey, but it's actually a really serious holiday, and this has been good preparation for me.
Thanks for listening. If you have a comment on this show, or if you'd like to let us know what you think or suggest topics for us to discuss, you can email us at tish@jpmedia.co, or you can leave a comment at our website, jpmedia.co. We always love hearing from you, seriously. We also have a little favor to ask. If you could find us on iTunes and leave a rating and review, it's really helpful to new listeners to hear from you what you think about the show, and then search for Jewish Public Media on Facebook and like us there too. You'll always know when a new episode drops, and you can use the Facebook page to suggest topic ideas and let us know what you think of our episodes. You're listening to this podcast for free, but it was not free to produce. If you'd like to support Jewish Public Media, please head over to our website, jpmedia.co, and hit the donate button. See you next month.